If tasted early, Dixon has found, the fine suspended matter in the coffee lends it an undeniable rustic piquance. Later in the pot, the liquid charring itself toward vileness appeals more to those looking for bodily stimuli. Like Dixon, who is able to sip the most degradedly awful pot's end poison and yet beam like an idiot. Best Jamoke west of the Alleghenies. A phrase Overseer Barnes utters often, though neither surveyor quite understands it, especially as the party are yet east of the Alleghenies. Albeit, at this point in a pot's life cycle, Mason prefers to switch over to tea, when it is Dixon's turn to begin shaking his head. Can't understand how anyone abides that stuff. How so? Mason, unable not to react. Well, it's disgusting, isn't it? Half-rotted leaves, scalded with boiling water, and then left to lie and soak and bloat. Disgusting? This is tea, friend, cha, what all tasteful London drinks. That, pollicating the coffee pot, is what's disgusting. Au contraire, Dixon replies, coffee is an art where precision is all. Water temperature, mean particle diameter, ratio of coffee to water, or as we say, CTW, and dozens more variables I'd mention, were they not so clearly out of thy technical grasp. How is it, Mason pretending amiable curiosity, that of each pot of coffee only the first cup is ever worth drinking, and that by the time I get to it, someone else has already drunk it? Dixon shrugs. You must improve your speed. As to the other, why I, only the first cup's any good, owing to coffee's sacramental nature, the sacrament being penance, entirely absent from my sunlit world of tea. Whereby the remainder of the pot, often dozens of cups deep, represents the price for enjoying that first perfect cup. Folly, gapes Mason. Why, every cup of tea is perfect. Or what, curing hides? For the next 3 weeks, they are occupied again with the enigmatic area round the tangent point, seeking to close the eastern boundaries of Pennsylvania and Maryland, the commissioners, to appearance, being anxious upon this score. They all live upon this side of Susquehanna, Mr. McLean conjectures. They don't want you across it just yet. Across it, things are not so civilized, so Anglican, begging your pardon, sir, nor so Quaker, begging yours, sir, or should I say thine. Over Susquehanna begins a different province entirely, and beginning at the mountains, another differing from that, and so on. Beyond Monongahela, beyond Ohio, though the betting in the taverns is overwhelmingly against your getting quite that far. Won't that depend upon how far the proprietors wish the line to run? Inquires Mr. Mason. If by the proprietors you mean those who truly own it, remarks John Harland. The Indians, suggests Mr. Dixon. The army, says Mr. Harland. I meant rather the pens, Mason a bit starched, as Maryland's grant ends just past Laurel Hill, from there west 'tis Penn's line alone, dividing Penn lands from Virginia, who bear none of the cost. 5 degrees from the Atlantic coast, opines Mr. McLean, will include Fort Pitt, and the first few miles of Ohio before it bends south. Iron deposits, coal as well, underground mountain ranges of it, burning down there for centuries, known to the Indians, perhaps used as well in connection with their mysterious lead mines in the mountains. Right up your street, Mr. Dixon. The surveyors soon discover that the meridian drawn north from the tangent point will run slightly inside the 12-mile arc, crossing it twice at points about a mile and a half apart, producing now between them 2 boundary lines, one straight and one about 1/1000th of a mile longer, curved, which will one day be declared the legal boundary, thus whittling a tiny sliver from Maryland. The 3.5 miles to the west line remaining can be run as a piece of pure meridian, to be styled the north line. All I know, Mason shrugs, is I'm supposed to line up Alioth and Polaris with the flame of a candle a mile away being held by you, who at the same time must ever be bisecting the flame perfectly with the string of your plummet. Unless it sets the string on fire, of course. So Dixon is sent out into darkness variable as the moon, thick with predators, bestial and human, Indians upon missions forever secret from European eyes, all moving easily among this community of night, interrupted only by the odd, unscheduled idiot. Even animals are late to arrive at waterholes, and so run into others in the herd, away from whom the latecomers would as gladly have kept. and herd politics takes another strange and unforeseen turn. Through it all, there is the unsure and withal helpless assistant, moving his lantern about in the air, whilst a distant voice through a speaking trumpet bids him go right, then left. Frankly, Mason chuckles by way of what he fancies encouragement, were I watching from the darkness, I shouldn't want to get too close to anyone in a peculiar hat, shouting in a loud metal voice. The savages may be as frightened of you as were the people in Cecil County last winter. Wasn't I that frightened them. They took me for the apprentice, no more. I saw you, deny it all you like, I saw you conversing with that torpedo. No, they were but more of thy visions, Mason. Thou were having them hourly by then, which is when, in fact, everyone grew frightened of thee. Another few days of bad weather, and he spreads his hands with a pitying gaze. At last, on June 6th, in a meadow belonging to Captain John Singleton, nearly 50 chains east of Mr. Reese Price's house, where the meridian and parallel intersect, the surveyors sink in a post, marked W upon the west side and N upon the north, and the boundary is closed. Here, at the northeast corner of Maryland, the geometrical pilgrim may well wish to stand in the company of his thoughts, at this purest of intersections marked so far upon America. Yet, geomancer, beware. If thy gaze but turn eastward by an eyelash's diameter, thou must view the notorious wedge, resulting from the failure of the tangent point to be exactly at this corner of Maryland, but rather some 5 miles south, creating a semicusp or thorn of that length and doubtful ownership, not so much claimed by any one province as prized for its ambiguity, occupied by all whose wish, hardly uncommon in this era of fluid identity, is not to reside anywhere. As a peaceful and meadow-like vista sweeps southward, the line and the arc approach one another, one may imagine almost sensibly. Bearing in from either limb of sight, a thrum, like peevish Dumbledore's in flight, as great Tox has it in his Pennsylvaniad. Yet there remains to the wedge an unseen world, beyond resolution of transactions never recorded, upon creeksides and beneath hedges, in barns, lofts, and spring houses, in the long summer maize fields where one may be lost within minutes of entering the vast unforgiving thickets of stalks. Indeed, all manner of secret paths and clearings and alcoves are defined, pushed over or stamped into being, roofless as ruins, but for a few fugitive weeks of lull before autumnal responsibilities come again looming. The sun burns, the gravid short forests beckon. The soil, when enough is revealed, becomes another sand arena. Anybody may be in there, from clandestine lovers to smugglers of weapons, some hawking contraband, buckles, lockets, tea, laces from France, some marking off lots for use in some future piece of land jobbery. Insect pests are almost intimidated into leaving, but sooner or later come back. Nearby, withal, is Iron Hill, a famous and semi-magical magnetic anomaly known to elf communities near and far, into which riskers of other people's capital have been itching for years to dig, but being reluctant to reward more than one set of provincial officials at a time, are waiting until the legal status of the wedge becomes clear. Is it part of Pennsylvania, Maryland, or of the new entity, Delaware, which on paper at least belongs to Pennsylvania, William Penn's having leased it from the Duke for a term of 10,000 years, though it has enjoyed, for 50 of these, its own legislature and executive council? Is no one's for the moment. A small geographic anomaly, a bustle with appetites high and low, their offerings and acceptances. The north line quickly completed, the surveyors are ordered back to Susquehanna, this time to continue the west line as far as the country is inhabited. Legally, this suggests as far as the proclamation line at the crest of the Alleghenies. Even before the party reaches the river, as if 'twere a fate neither could avoid, Darby and Cope are pretending to be Mason and Dixon, though not always respectively. It begins when someone having observed the chain assumes the obvious. Mr. Mason, and this must be Mr. Dixon. Not exactly, says Cope. He means, Darby hastily puts in, that he's Mason and I'm Dixon. Isn't that right, Mason? I'd prefer to be Dixon, hisses Cope. Next time, all right. The links of the chain caked with dried dirt and squeaking almost painfully. You'll want to take care, they're eventually warned by a friendly tapster. They're a couple of lads about pretending to be you two. Get on, says Darby. Why should anyone wish to be us, wonders Cope. Maidens, in varying ratios of indignation to curiosity, show up in camp, demanding to see Mason or Dixon or both. Upon meeting the real surveyors, well, but you're not him, nor you the other. Of course not, reply Mason and Dixon. When they have a moment to talk about it together, it must be someone in camp, Mason suggests. My guess is 'tis Darby and Cope. How, then? Well, they're never about, are they, when all these folks show up to complain, and their names, like ours, are usually spoken together. Yet you know more of chained men than I. What think ye? The chained man's sorrows, it seems to Dixon, all proceed from being forbidden, but upon sufferance of the party chief, so much as to touch any instrument, excepting the chain, with centuries of that word's poetic associations adding to its weight. Farmers in Durham aren't the only ones who call it the devil's guts. Chain men bear it, they hate it, they tend it carefully, their feelings ever in a muddle. They cannot keep from sliding queer, covetous glances at the other instruments. They understand the surveyor's injunction, yet touch they must and will, some honestly wishing to learn more of the arts, others merely to fiddle with the equipment. That Monsieur Darby and Cope, being, here in America, surveyors fully competent with all instruments, should now toil as chain men, under British supervision withal? Invidious situations arise, do they see? Then shall we break with tradition, perhaps allow them to use our surveying instruments? Or yours, rather, as I possess none of my own. What? My circumferenter? Why, 'tis another of my very senses. 'Twould be like letting someone else do my smelling for me. So, you and this instrument are quite close, then? Do you have a name that you call it by? Mason, the thought of either Darby's or Cope's eyeball dripping fluid all over the lenses of my old Cirque. Ah, old Cirque! How charming you people are! How childlike in your attachments! Perhaps if the tools of thy trade had ever belonged to thee instead of to the king, thou might at least once have felt this simple sentimental bond. Quite common among the people, in fact, though scarcely, I guess, among all those great public zenith sectors and telescopes and so forth, up there but a footfall from the highest in the land. Mason drops his head in false apology. Yet another flaw. How many more before my character's too riddled for it to matter? Dixon, I know I am not worthy to carry your esteemed instrument. Blessing upon you both, and much joy of your relationship. Thank ye, Mason. I mean that sincerely. As to our chain men, they being qualified blends folk, might we not allow them some time with the sector, neither of us actually owning it? Fine with me. I've but its custodians to report to. You must answer to its maker. John Bird would do the same, I'm certain. Deferring as ever in matters of character, Mason making mock French flourishes in the air with his hat. Why, here are the gents themselves. A miracle. Fetch me the Jesuit telegraph, for I must report it to the Pope. How now, boys? Far too truculent, mutters Mason. Mr. Cope, Mr. Darby, well met. We prefer Darby and Cope, actually, says Darby. He being the head and all, adds Cope. Of course, that's only east to west. Depending on who ends up with the stobs, really. Going on to describe, in foul copy Stickomythia, their practice of exchanging 10 small wood stakes to keep the chain count accurate, though between Mr. Darby's habit of keeping stobs everywhere about him, including in his belt, leggings, and hat, and Mr. Cope's forgetfulness in counting, they have grown so fearful of stob loss as to have begun exchanging stobs after 11 chains instead of 10, with Mr. Cope then passing back only 9 of his and keeping 1. Yet now one, and now the other will forget and revert to the old 10-chain method. We may be miles off by now, Dixon's eyes having grown very round. Save that through some dark miracle of Mathesis, says Darby, our errors have ever exactly cancelled out. Else Susquehanna, measured to Potomac, might haply maze the traveller loxodromic. With phantom leagues, too many or too few, as if a very hole in space twere, too. A pause, not a mischievous dimple upon either fizz. All content otherwise, Mason, as he imagined smoothly. Go easy, Mason, don't upset them. "'Twas him made me do it,' screams Mr. Cope, as if yielding before a sudden stress. "'Booby,' ejaculates Mr. Darby, "'twas you began it. "'Yet head everything must you ever be, mustn't you, "'leaving poor, miserable Cope to shift as he may.' "'Made thee do what?' inquires Dixon. "'Uh-huh, you see,' cries Mason. "'Now they are confessing.' "'Actually, the chain men are fallen rather to thumping one the other, "'as Mason and Dixon look on. "'Then again,' confides Mason behind his hand, "'a turn at the sector mightn't be such a good idea, not just now.' "'There is commotion up the visto. "'A delegation of newly hired axemen come marching in. "'Here are the very subjects,' cries one of these.' Now then, ye heathen, hold. 'Tis not how we Christians settle our differences. Yet they seem like white men. Cleverly, indeed, fiendishly disguised, though Darby and Cope are not quite British names, are they? Why, they are as British as anyone here, Dixon points out. Not according to your pay list. See here, it reads Darby and Cope, Chinamen. That's chain men. Ah, not the same. Oh, dear. Is Mr. Barnes but fun-mongering, and we the gulls? Pity, really, none of us has seen a Chinaman before. Soon, promises the oracular Squire Halligast, in a voice so charged with passion that immediately all but the most desperate of the axemen believe him. By the 22nd of June, they are back below the Peach Bottom Ferry, another Saturday night, ready to start west again. There rushes the river. Both surveyors understanding by now, 'tis not only a river, being as well the boundary to another country. Next day they measure southward about 45 feet to correct their error in latitude, and there placed a mark, and in the direction of this, and the mark on the east side of the river, we proceeded to run the line. Just before they cross Susquehanna, a parcel arrives for them by way of a lathered youth riding express upon a black barb, neither showing any sign of tiring. With a terrible yee-haw, the youth sweeps off his tricorn, wheels, and has galloped back into the brush. In the package is Father Boscovich's book, De Solis et Lunae Defectibus, published at last, dispatched transatlantically by Maskline, who, in the jobation accompanying, invites their attention to a great variety of data within, including a warning as to the attraction of mountains. In Italy, 'twas established that the Umbrian Apennines caused a very considerable deviation of the plumb line northward, as the party moving in that direction drew ever closer. First, the iron loads disable my needle, moans Dixon. Now the mountains are about to throw off my plummet. Obliging us, as Maskelyne and me at St. Helena, to take symmetrical readings on the opposite sides of the crests and hope that the two errors will cancel out. I pray the western slopes of Allegheny may prove less distressing than the windward side of that wretched island. Chapter 49. To appearance, Trans-Susquehanna is peaceful enough. Farmhouses, a schoolhouse, a road to York. At the third 10-minute segment of arc, they calculate their probable error, change direction by an RPH to the northward, and continue to their next stopping place, which once again shall place them conveniently, this time besides the great inland road between York and Baltimore, more real than any imaginary line any would run athwart it. The earth hereabouts is red, the tone of a new brick wall in the shadow, due to a high ratio of iron. And if tilled in exactly the right way, it becomes magnetized too, so that at harvest time 'tis necessary only to pass along the rows any large container of iron, and the vegetables will fly up out of the ground and stick to it. Ahead of them, in the next 10 minutes of arc, lie a dozen streams falling into Gunpowder Creek, which runs roughly parallel to the visto and about a mile south of it. The last of these branches, being close enough to another 10 minutes west, upon crossing it they need only calculate their error as before, and aim slightly north, so as to fall in again with their proper latitude 10 minutes west of that. In such easy hops through the summer fields and the German cooking do they progress, Susquehanna to the Allegheny Mountain. Some mornings they awake and can believe that they traverse an Eden, unbearably fair in the dawn, squandering all its beauty, day after day unseen, bearing them fruits, presenting them game, bringing them a fugitive moment of peace. How for days at a time can they not, dizzy with it, believe themselves passed permanently into dream? Summer takes hold, manifold sweet odors of the fields, and presently the forest become routine. And one night the surveyors sit in their tent, in the dark, and watch fireflies, millions of them blinking everywhere. Dixon engineering plans for lighting the campsite with them, recalling how his brother George, back home, ran coal gas through reed piping along the orchard wall. Jeremiah will lead the fireflies to stream continuously through the tent in a narrow band, here and there to gather in glass globes, concentrating their light to the yellow of a new-risen moon. And when we move to where there are none of these tiny link men? We take them with us. Lifetime employment. But how long do they live? Ensign cheer. As the visto has grown longer behind them, the Philadelphia-ward fringe of the nightly encampment has lengthened to a suburbs, dedicated to high, as some would say low, living. Gaming, corn whiskey, women able to put up with a heap of uncompensated overtime, stages knocked together each nightfall and lanterned into view to a murmur as of a great crowd in motion, only to be struck again each dawn. As those for whom it is cheaper to follow than to abandon the party for business elsewhere, groaning with the night just past, hoping for a chance to sleep sometime during the journey, prepare to follow the axemen through another day. The fast and loose artist, the quartz scryer, the Vasquez Brothers marimba quartet, who often play backup for the torpedo, to whom it is the music of his youth, his home waters. The marimbas, in great towering structure assembled each evening just outside of camp, pulse along, chords and arpeggiations swaying upward to their sharp versions, then back down again, sets of hammers, hands, and sleeves, all moving together along the ranked wood notes, nocturnal, energetic, remembrancing, warning, impelling. The anthem of the expedition as it moves into the unknown is Pepinazos, marching and rolling, but wishing rather to dance. Pepinazos, nunca abrazos, si me quieras, si de veras, oigame, dejate, los pepinazos. All summer they labor in the service of the line over Codorus, Conewago, pausing to set up the sector, dodging inch and a half hailstones, calculating offsets, changing direction, cross Piney Run and Monocacy Road, and the creeks beyond, till just past Middle Creek, figuring they are about in their latitude, without bothering to set up the sector, the surveyors turn off the angle calculated to put them another 10 minutes on, at the South Mountain, in among all the ghosts already thick in those parts. "We are fools," proposes Dixon one night. "The wind has shifted at about sundown to the south-southeast, heightening even minor stresses among the company. We shouldn't be running this line." Mason regards his cup of claret. "Bit late for that, isn't it?" "Why, I'll carry it through, friend, fear not. But something invisible's going on. Thou must feel it, smell it." Mason shrugs. "American politics." "Just so. We're being used again. It doesn't alarm thee?" An accident of the late light has filled Mason's orbits with colored shadows. Resign? They would bring up the letter, immediately. Then? Dixon nods glumly, and Mason keeps on, more than he has to. "Though we're in this together, yet is it easier for you, being the Quaker and not expected to prove combative, than for me, who must accordingly bear double the burden of bravery." "Splendid! Did they team us up together like this deliberately? Are you my penalty, precise to the groat, for enjoying a command of my own? For not having seconded mask mine at the transit? Now I have to be air-coot? Bit steep, isn't it?" Mason begins fiddling with his cue, bringing it first over one shoulder, then the other. If it were all true, every unkind suspicion, every fantastical rendering, would we, knowing all, nonetheless go on, do what's clearly our duty? We signed an agreement. If it meant our destruction? The ancient matter of the seahorse must ever prevent us from resigning. We've no choice but to go on with it, as far as we may. Then, as we've no choice, I may speak freely and share with you some of my darker sentiments. Suppose Maskline's a French spy. Suppose a secret force of Jesuits receives each day a summary of observations made at Greenwich and transcalculates it according to a system known to the Kabbalists of the 2nd century as Gematria, whereby messages may be extracted from lines of text, sacred and otherwise, a knowledge preserved by various custodians over the centuries, and since the last, possessed by Jesuit and Freemason alike. The dispute over Bradley's obs, then, as over Flamsteed's before him, would keep ever as their unspoken intention that the numbers nocturnally obtained be set side by side, and arranged into lines like those of a text, manipulated till a message be revealed. Bit sophisticated for me. Though I don't mind a likely conspiracy, I prefer it to be formed in the interests of trade. The mystical sort you fancy is fair beyond me. I'm but a simple son of the pit. Trade. Aha! You heard me mention Jesuits, so now you're making veiled allusions to the East India Company in response. I do see, yes. Drivel, of course. Come, sir, can you not sense here, there, just round the corner, the pattering feet and swift hands of John Company, the lanterns of the East, the scent of fresh coriander, the whisper of a sarong? Sorry, corrects Mason. Not at all, sir. 'Twas I who was sarong. Since the party crossed Susquehanna, Armand has been marinating in melancholy, owing to Louise's departure. Even Dixon had seen it coming. Frenchy and Mrs. Redzinger, they're scarcely together of late. Did they notice? As they draw nearer the Redzinger farm, the presence of Peter Redzinger becomes quite sensible to all. Indeed, he's been back since the winter. He and the boys have been working the place, lumbering about insomniac, eating whenever they happen to remember, tracking soil everywhere, hardly speaking. To Louisa, he seems chastened, even at times dejected, yet innocent of all suspicion as respects his wife, having long traveled past the conjugal emotions, belonging to the simple fact of another hard Pennsylvania winter, the lowness and solidity of sky, no day without its distress, roads that end in thickets at nightfall. Christ went away, he discovers at last how to tell her, one morning, the eaves adrip, the bleary sun irregularly brighter and dimmer. One day, for no reason that I could see, Christ came to me and said, Peter, I am going away. You thought it was hard before this? Here is where it gets impossible. Are you coming back? I almost couldn't speak. You must live ever in that expectation. Come, spare me that face. Of course it is a lot to ask. He seemed in a dangerously merry state. Was it relief at being shut of me at last? How do I proceed without you? What have I been teaching you all this time? I was smit dumb, Louisa. I didn't understand the question. Be more like you, I tried. He'd been teaching me. All this time, vey. Alas, his smile at least was not a pitying one, nor was it quite as disappointed as I'd feared. He turned. For the first time I saw the back of his robe. He had a motto in German, embroidered fine as could be in gold threads upon the back. I couldn't read what it said. He receded. He was gone. Peter! I feel cold, helpless without him. I believed I could count upon him forever. He was there. He was real. Then he turned and went away. I have displeased him. But how? I loved him. All day, half the night, on he talks, stunned and sing-song. He does not weep as much as Louisa expects. Armand has a swift look in from time to time, smiles understandingly, heaves a sigh, withdraws. Louisa waits to grow impatient. She considers the Frenchman for the first time with unrestrained desire. Having glimpsed the possibility that they may never have a chance to address it, she can also appreciate how tiresome this listening to Peter is. Yet, from some unexplored region to her spirit's west, like upland folk with goods to sell, come messengers with the late news that her destiny, spite all, may lie with this crazed, Christless wreck of a husband, or, as she will also find herself asking in tears upon any number of future occasions, what else was I supposed to do? What? That Frenchman and his duck? I actually tried for a while to tell Peter about our little trio, but I couldn't even do that, for he never heard me. He was too full of old adventures, out past Monongahela, with Christ, going about in various disguises, Christ and his hop-field companion Peter upon missions of education. Christ and Peter visit the Indians. Christ reminisces about his teen years. Christ teaches Peter how to make golems. Excuse me, Louisa, your husband, he... makes golems. Oh, not the big ones, Lotta. No, kitchen size. Some of them quite clever, the tasks they do. One that peels and cores apples. Yeah, even pits cherries. Louisa, for shame. The women beam together mischievously. One day, however, Louisa will show her. Peter will not mind. Pennsylvania is a place of spiritual wonders, amazing as any chasm or cataract. Among the German farmers of Lancaster, for example, are scores, perhaps hundreds, of truly, literally good people, escaped from a hell we in our small, tended quotidian may but try to imagine. Entire villages put to flame, and tortures worse than inquisitorial, disembowelments, bloodlettings, a world without innocence. Yet, escaped here, into innocence reborn, something deeper and more intricate, they call it a new life in Christ, it is their way of explaining it. Not a moment of their waking day passes without some form of Christian devotion. Work, which the rest of us, at one time or another, have cursed and wished at an end, is here considered sacred, and this is only one of many wonders. Never has traveler encountered such personal variety, where utter cleanliness and sobriety may be seen immediately adjoining the most stupefied exhibitions of hemp-field folly. There are Germanical mystics who live in trees, not up in the branches, but actually within the trunks, those particularly of ancient creekside sycamores, which have, over time, become hollowed out, like caverns. In the midst of these lightless woods are gunsmithies, where the most advanced and refined forms of art are daily exercised upon the machinery of murder by craftsmen whose piety is unquestioned. Wick's Cherry Coke, Spiritual Daybook. Depew recalls a sermon he once heard at a church full of German mystics. It might have been a lecture in mathematics. Hell beneath our feet bounded, heaven above our pates unbounded. Hell, a collapsing sphere, heaven, an expanding one. The enclosure of punishment, the release of salvation. Sin leading us as naturally to hell and compression, as doth grace to heaven and rarefaction. Thus, murmurs of thus, may each point of heaven be mapped or projected upon each point of hell and vice versa. And what intercepts the projection about midway, reckoned logarithmically, between? Why, this very earth and our lives here upon it. We only think we occupy a solid brick and timber city. In reality, we live upon a map. Perhaps even our lives are but representations of truer lives, pursued above and below, as to Philadelphia correspond both a vast heavenly city and a crowded niche of hell, each element of one faithfully mirrored in the others. There are a Mason and Dixon in hell, you mean? Inquires Ethelmer, attempting eternally to draw a perfect arc of considerably lesser circle? Impossible, ventures the Reverend. For is hell by this scheme not a point without dimension? Indeed, yet suppose hell to be almost a point, argues the doughty Depew, already Wrangler material. They would then be inscribing their line eternal upon the inner surface of the smallest possible spheroid that can be imagined, and then some. More of these, Ethelmer pretending to struggle for a modifier that will not offend the company, curious infinitesimals, cousin. The masters at my purgatory are bewitched by the confounded things. Epsilons, usually, miserable little, squiggling in the air, sort of things, eh? See them often, sighs Depew, this session more than ever. What puzzles me, D.P., is that if the volume of hell may be taken as small as you like, yet the souls therein must be ever smaller, mustn't they? There being, by now, easily millions there. I, assuming one of the terms of damnation be to keep just enough of one's size and weight to feel oppressively crowded, taking as a model the old black hole of Calcutta, if you like, the soul's volume must be an epsilon 1 degree smaller, a sub-epsilon. The epsilonics of damnation. Well, well, there's my next sermon, remarks Uncle Wicks. I observe, Tenebrae transformed by the pale taper light to some beautiful needlewoman in an old painting, of both of you, that your fascination with hell is matched only by your disregard of heaven. Why should the surveyors not be found there above? Gesturing with her needle, a curve ensemble of embroidery floss, of a nearly invisible gray, trailing after, in the currents raised by talking, pacing, fanning, approaching, withdrawing, and whatever else there be to indoor life, drifting about, chaining the endless airy leagues, themselves approaching a condition of pure geometry. Though, for symmetry's sake, interposes Depew, we ought to say almost endless. Why, whispers Bree, whoever said anything had to be symmetrical? The lads, puzzled, exchange a quick look. Chapter 50. Not all roads lead to Philadelphia. Chesapeake means as much, and often more, to the back inhabitants as Philadelphia. So roads here seldom run in the same sense as the West Line, but rather athwart it, coming up from Chesapeake and going on to the north and the west. Soon, lesser roads, linking farms and closer markets, begin to feed into these line-crossing roads. Before long, on one or more of the corners so defined, a tavern will appear. It is thus, in the back country, evident to all, however unschooled in Euclid, that each time the Visto crosses a road, there's sure to be an oasis but a few miles north or south. Here's how we'll do it, proposes Mason. Whenever we come to a road, one of us goes north, the other south. The one not finding a tavern in a reasonable time returns to the line, where he finds either the other waiting or that the other has not yet returned, in which case he then continues in the same direction, either meeting the other returning or finding him already a dozen pints down. East of Susquehanna, under this system, there prove to be crossings where inns lie both north and south of the line. And on such occasions, entire days may pass with each surveyor in his own tavern, not exactly waiting for the other to show up, possibly imagining the good time the other must be having and failing to share. Later, across Susquehanna, there come days when the only inns are worse than no inn, and presently days when there are no inns at all. And at last the night they encamp, knowing that for an unforeseeable stretch of nights they must belong to this great swell of forested mountains, this place of ancient revenge and beasts outside the firelight, the sun this particular evening, as if in celestial seal, spreading into a glory, transgressing all metes and bounds, filling the trees, lighting the animals, their flanks averted, washed in its oncoming flow, bringing to human faces a precision approaching purification, goading each soul as if again and again ever toward the shambles of eternity. The axemen stand beneath it, no less bruised, worn, or hungry than from any other day, blinking, turning away, then returning to this radiance that flares from behind edges of shapes uncertain, the creation they believe they know recreated. Later, not all will agree on what they have seen. Thus, as the communication is a long sequence of fortified remounting stations, so is the line a long sequence of taverns and ordinaries and absences of the same. One day, the meridian having been closely enough established, and with an hour or two of free time available to them, one heads north, one south, and his Dixon's luck to discover the Rabbi of Prague, headquarters of a Kabbalistic faith in correspondence with the elect Kohens of Paris, whose private salute they now greet Dixon with, the fingers spread two and two, and the thumb held away from them likewise, said to represent the Hebrew letter Shin and to signify, live long and prosper. The area just beyond the next ridge is believed to harbor a giant golem, or Jewish automaton, taller than the most ancient of the trees. As explained to Dixon, 'twas created by an Indian tribe widely supposed to be one of the famous lost tribes of Israel, who had somehow given up control of the creature, sending it headlong into the forest, where it would learn of its own gift of mobile invisibility. And do you folk wear special hats, anything like that? Inquires Dixon. It sounds enough like the Frenchman's duck to make him cautious. Most of thee, in speech and address, I'd have guessed to be Irish. I thought thee were known for little people. This is a wonder of the wilderness for fair. If, I say if, you do see it, advises the landlord, you'll then talk of wonders indeed. Sure, that golem, you have to catch him when he's asleep, asserts a short, red-headed woodsman in deerskins who is holding a tankard in one hand and a Lancaster County rifle in the other. Of course, adds a florid forge keeper who occupies the entire side of one table, that might not be for years. he chuckles, and the tankards rattle upon the shelves. Aye, some of us have never seen him, only heard his steps on the nights when there is no moon, or his voice speaking from above the only words he knows, Aya, Asher, Aya, in on which, in tones hushed, though ominous, the others now join. That is, I am that which I am, helpfully translates a somehow nautical-looking individual with gigantic forearms and one eye ever asquint from the smoke of his pipe. Though Rashi, in his commentary, has, I will be what I will be, as the tense is ambiguous between present and future. Isn't that what God said to Moses? Dixon inquires. Exodus, chapter 4, verse 14. 'Tis what the Indians will say to you if you go far enough west, being the lost tribes of Israel out there, whose creature this is. In the infancy gospel of Thomas, you see, Jesus, as a boy, made small, as you'd say, toy golems out of clay, sparrows that flew, rabbits that hopped. Golem fabrication is integral to the life of Jesus and thence to Christianity. Nor is it any wonder here by South Mountain, anyway. Sometimes the invisible will all at once appear. Sometimes what you see may not be there at all. I am told of certain stars in the Chinese system of astrology which are invisible so long as they keep moving, only being seen when they pause. Might thy golem share this property? The company rushed to enlighten Dixon. 'Tis shared with this whole accursed continent, the quarrelsome Carrot Top lets him know, waving his rifle and narrowly missing several tankards upon the table, which, as if in answer to God's recession, remained invisible, denied to us, till it became necessary to our souls that it come to rest, self-revealed, though we pretended to discover it. By the time of Columbus, God's project of disengagement was obvious to all, with the terrible understanding that we were to be left more and more to our own solutions. America, withal, for centuries, had been kept hidden, as are certain bodies of knowledge. Only now and then were selected persons allowed glimpses of the new world. Never reporters that anyone else was likely to believe, men who ate the flesh and fornicated with the ghosts of their dead, murderers and pirates on the run, monks in parchment coracles stitched together from copied pages of the Book of Jonah, fishermen too many nights out of port, any runagate crazed enough to sail west. All matters of what becomes visible and when. Revelation exists as a fact and continues as time proceeds. If new continents may become visible, why not planets, sir, as planets are in your line? He'd have to ask Mason, who should be here hourly. Albeit, the secret was safe until the choice be made to reveal it. It has been denied to all who came to America for wealth, for refuge, for adventure. This new world was ever a secret body of knowledge, meant to be studied with the same dedication as the Hebrew Kabbalah would demand. Forms of the land, the flow of water, the occurrence of what used to be called miracles, all are text, to be attended to, manipulated, read, remembered. Hence, as you may imagine, we take a lively interest in this line of yours, booms the forge keeper, inasmuch as it may be read, east to west, much as a line of text upon a page of the sacred Torah, a Tellurian scripture, as some might say. 'Twill terminate somewhere to the west. No one, not even you and your partner, knows where. An utterance, a message of uncertain length, apt to be interrupted at any moment, or chain. A smaller pantograph copy down here of occurrences in the higher world. Another case of as above, so below. No longer, alas, a phrase of power. This age sees a corruption and disabling of the ancient magic. Projectors, brokers of capital, insurancers, peddlers upon the global scale, enterprisers and quacks. These are the last poor fallen and feckless inheritors of a knowledge they can never use but in the service of greed. The coming rebellion is theirs, Franklin and that lot, and heaven help the rest of us if they prevail. Yes, puts in a queer, uncollected sort of townsman who's been drinking so far in silence, what of the way Mr. Franklin and his people stopped the Paxtonians before the city, as the Pope halted Attila before Rome? Like Leo first upon the Mincian bank, before that horde, rank after endless rank. Yes, and now as then, the preponderant question is, what kind of arrangements were made? With conquest in their grasp and sight, our own barbarians and likewise turned and sought once again their wild backlands, renouncing their chance to sack the Quaker Rome. Enjoy its women, general comment. Careful, lad, some of them's us. Just so. What argument could have proved compelling enough to dissuade them? The kite, the key, the mortal thundering as heaven's flame assaults the hempen string. Eh? For they esteem Franklin a magician, a figure of power. We know what he is, but to the mobility he is the ancestor of miracle, or of wonders which pass as well with them, without which, indeed, they would soon grow inquisitive and troublesome. For as long as it remains possible to keep us deluded that we are free men, we back inhabitants will feed the metropolis, open new roads to it, fight in its behalf. We may be Presbyterian today, and turned only by the force of God, but after very few seasons of such remorseless gulling, we must be weak and tractable enough even for the Philadelphian men of affairs, who themselves cannot be reckoned as any sort of faithful, but rather among doubt's advancing phalanx, of whom one must ask, if they no longer believe in bishops, where next might their irreverence not take them? Now then, lad, 'tis Patrick Henry, sir, they've all got the itch. Why, these Presbyterians need no oratory from the likes of me, not men who every day face savages seeking to destroy them, who will set and hold a line of defense quite well before Schuylkill, though 'twill be deists and illuminati and philosophers, even stranger than that, poised upon the mountaintops between, to observe and, who can say, direct the engagement. In pale and lanterned reverie, the fair of Philadelphia lounge, discussing hair. Whilst in the steep shade of some western alp, a Presbyterian's fighting for his scalp. These lines that keep quoting, I know I should recognize them. Is it Alexander Pope? Why, 'tis Mr. Tox, a certain impatience of the eyebrows. A poet whom, that is, in the constellation Poesia, sir, to frame it in more comfortable terms for you, even the wasp of Twickenham must be assigned the letter beta, for 'tis Timothy Tox who is its lumina. I was quoting from the Pennsylvaniad, of course. Of course. Oh, go on then, Tim, tell him. You are... Not so loud. This is not my home. I am upon the scamper, I fear, though none will speak of it. Like Mr. Wilkes, I have endangered my freedom by printing what displeaseth this king. Not the king, you appreciate. He peers at Dixon as a physician might, waiting for some sign. Only a broadside, no more than a couple of hundred copies. Went something like, as legionaries once in skirts patrolled the streets of old Londinium, damp and cold, so troops in kilts invade us now unbeckoned, styling themselves the Highland 42nd. Who is this king that fires upon his own? Who are these ministers with heads of stone? Holy experiment, oh, where be thou? Where be thy hopes, thy fears, thy terrors now? Outside, great percussions upon the earth are heard, coming ever closer. Trees, pushed over, crash to the ground. Bears, bobcats, and wolves come fleeing before whatever is just behind. Pewter dances across the boards of the tables. Ale trembles in every can. Observing Timothy Tox's brightness of eye and steadfastness of lip, Dixon pretends astonishment. Have thou summoned it here with thy verses? Somewhat as ye may summon a star with a telescope. I pray no more than that. No friend of the king, I collect. An American golem. They thought the black boys who fought them at Fort Loudon were dangerous. Those were benevolent elves in comparison. Here, as in Prague, the golem takes a dim view of oppression and is ever available to exert itself to the contrary. Out the window, great mud feet are seen to stir, tall as the eaves. The countrymen raise tankards in their direction. A sovereign deterrent to Black Watch plaid, declares Mr. Tox. This forest suffers not the bagpipe scream. To stay away, the Brits it wiser deem. Chapter 51. South Mountain is the last concentration of apparitions, as you might say, shape morphers and soul snatchers, besides plain ghosts. Beyond lies wilderness, where quite another presence reigns, undifferentiate, that which ever precedeth ghostliness. Dixon takes to wearing a coonskin cap. Mason is alarmed. that something has happened to your hair, is what he says aloud, whilst thinking that Dixon has become a werewolf, or even worse, some new world creature without a name, at home among the illimitable possibilities of evil in this forest, some manifestation to daylight denied. Meanwhile, Dixon, sensing in his partner but a lower order of snakes and bears' jumpiness, in fun begins appearing at the tent opening with the tail of the hat pulled round in front of his face, screaming in a pitman's cant, intelligible but to himself. Mason's reactions are all he is hoping for and more. The quill goes into a panicky skate off the page. Mason looks frantically about for a weapon. Dixon quickly reverses the bushy tail. Surprise? Not funny. Don't like me, Chapeau? Well, I hadn't done Punch's voice yet. At Mason's blank look. I mean, thou've never done this with thy wig? The children love it. Fascinating. Apparently, I was never allowed the opportunity. My older son, William, having learned quite soon to remove mine from my head and convert it into a toy cudgel, with which, charmingly, of course, he would pretend to smash his baby brother's head in. The powder always made him sneeze, although this did not affect the sincerity of his assault. But the word always has slipped in, fatal to any attempt at wit or even lightness of tone, and maybe Mason's way of asking for sympathy fully as supplicatory as a tremor in the voice, a fugitive tear. He has blundered on into a remark about hats, cocked and not. Sir? Dixon giving beef. Surely, sir, I meant no disrespect to the Quakers, among whom I number... 'Tis the dismissive use of metonymy, sir. We are particularly earnest upon the topic of hats, having invested in them more than insurance against the rain. Our history is a sect having begun with a hat that remained upon its head, and mercifully the head upon its body. Later, Mason seeks revenge. Dixon, having drifted into a hypnagogic passage in which, amid a profligacy of stars rushing by, he is traversing straight upward, zenithward. Hey, hey! He is awake and screaming. Mason is ringing a small iron bell rapidly in front of his nose. Indians? Americans? Where's my rifle? What? His Capella, smirks Mason, about to culminate. And though I do prefer the clock myself, as it is your, ye might say, workstation, reluctantly must I yield it to you, I suppose, and go clap me eye to the old snout once again. I wasn't asleep. Fair Blapsia, I am thine. Pray you, sir, a moment's mercy. Who said the? I didn't say the. Mason's look is poised between pity and annoyance. I've been awake. I remember when Farlow and Boggs came by, with their voucher situation. A lively whim-wham for fair. Boggs and Farlow didn't. That is to say, ah, happened 'twas thee asleep then. I puzzled that they spoke so quietly. I was awake all the time. They were never here. You must have dreamed it. Oh, thou looked awake, but I mind thy gift of sleeping with thine eyes open wide. I can't help that. My father did it, too. It's given me nightmares for years. I couldn't bear to look at it. How can you? Doesn't it trouble you? Me? Why, no. Why should it? Some individual pretending to stare at me whilst his soul's off God knows where, having adventures imperfectly recalled? Why should any of that trouble me? Particularly the question of what, in thy absence, is doing the staring for thee? What caretaker, what verger of the temple of the self, eh? Yes, and the stare you speak of, do my eyes, in a sense, roll upward into blind white ovoids, and are your dreams not invaded by that sinister unseeing gaze, ever charged with some imminent act you must upon no account remain there to witness? Aye, screams Dixon, aye, they're blank as boiled eggs, and worse, for irisless and unpupiled, yet do they go on squinting at me as if... Yes, yes. Eh, never mind. No, pray you, I'm interested, very interested indeed. Wind shoves against the tent. Rainwater somewhere drips into a kettle. The flames of the tallow dips are ever uncertain. From the forest now proceed sounds, real ones, that neither surveyor has heard before, and that each is too embarrassed to mention to the other. Dixon, having the finer tolerance for mysterious intrusion, breaks first. All right, I know you hear it too. It's rhythmic and high-pitched, I say it's Indian drums, and they're talking about us. And I say 'tis a dog, Mason, somber, a particular dog with a syncopated bark. Oh, yes, a dog well known and much feared in this region, withal a dog. Wait then, where's my flask, if we're having a toast to the animal? Outside, something is creeping by. Hold! Dixon, seizing a pistol and diving out the tent flap into the rain with a smoothness Mason has rarely observed. There is some jingling and shuffling. It's the young McLean, cries Dixon. Felicitude, mutters Mason. What next? Invite him in for a drink, I suppose? In pokes Dixon's head, considerably wetter. Nace of your mind, thinks it's a dog. I still say it's a drum, though perhaps of an unconventional design. Say, how much of that stuff in the bottles is to hand? They now are joined by other crew members who have heard and are unhappy with the pulsing, uncertainly distant noise. Wearily, Mason pulls on oilcloths, tugs his service-grade beaver over his knob, and emerges to mill about as perplexed as the rest, hoping no one will look to him for leadership. Soon the place is so full of crew that they decide to move on into the mess tent, where already Mr. Barnes and his band have been conversing separately. Gents, we are all agreed, the overseer greets them. 'Tis the, whispering for the first time since they've known him, black dog. Probably out seeking to relieve himself upon one or more of his personal trees, adds Matt Marine, which will no longer be there, having been chopped down for our visto. The B.D. will likely be very put out at this, for he does like his personal trees, you see. Shall he retaliate? Wonders Mason. What measures should we be taking? Mason. May I suggest that this all is but a form of joint mirage, offers the Reverend, something very like it having been reported in the Philosophical Transactions not long ago, as you may recall. Dixon's, why I, and Mason's, I do not, are spoken simultaneously. The surveyors glare at each other. Someone wrote in to the R.S. about this black dog, inquires Mason. Careful, warns Mr. Barnes, you're not supposed to use any of its names, really. Really? The black dog? Can't say the black... Shh! 'Tis one of the things that are never said. Oh, Dixon, curious, and the others are... An extended list, sir. And, of course, I'd rather not recite it aloud. Is it not yet enough, the Catholic axemen blessing their bits each morning with holy water, the astrologites newly reluctant to work when the moon is void, of course, the Presbyterians ever brewing potions and scrying the entrails of toads, and now a list of things that may not be said? Arr, Mason, a squint, finally set these days. Am I not given to understand that no Geordie can ever quite bring himself to pronounce the name of, don't say it, of a certain farm animal, noted for its wallowing and oinking? Be a gent, Mason, I concede the point. And you promise not to say the black d... Yep, that is. Folk out here advise, says Dixon, that all else failing, the names most likely to matter, spoken aloud, are those of the Holy Trinity, accompanied by a cross drawn in the air at the same time. Same time as what? As the dog is leaping for my throat? Disputes with phantom dogs are not in my line, Mason. Dogs love me. I'm a dog person. Are you really? All my life. So, if I threw a stick and cried fetch, you would actually run and... Mason places a finger crosswise between his teeth and nods inquiringly. No, no, not that kind of dog person, though happen I did see something like it once at Darlington Fair. Harkee, calls Moses Barnes, gentlemen. Has the wind only shifted, or is this damned howling come nearer? All attend the night outside the canvas walls. Ain't it more likely to be no dog, but Indians pretending to be a dog? Mr. Farlow inquires calmly, thereby throwing the company into a panic. Countrymen set their fur hats mistakenly upon the heads of others, or grab the wrong rifle, whilst it is yet in its owner's hands. Powder is spilled, strewn, left by the fire. Everyone is shouting at once. Leadership, Mason mumbling to himself, turning to Dixon. One of us, me as usual, pulling his hat down over his ears, he prepares to exit. Mr. Dixon is going out to have a look, Mason announces, quite chirpy. If it is a dog, he'll know what to do. What if it's Indians? I'll bite them. Dixon lifts the flap, clears his sensorium, and steps outside. There is a long silence. Mason has drifted into a curious daydream about Philadelphia, where he has just been elected dog catcher on the basis of his adventures upon South Mountain when Dixon comes back. wasn't the creature you spoke of. It was the glowing Indian. What? The glowing Indian of South Mountain? Hasn't been seen for years. Perhaps it was something else. Dixon accepts a pewter mug of May's whiskey. What would they call a very large Native American with a net output of light comparable to that of a forge? Dunno, glowing Indian. Just so. Hatchet and musket barrel and knife blades all aglow, steam billowing up when he stepped in the creek. Mason has no command of his tongue. He keeps trying to say, "Too far, Dixon. You never know where the crease of credulity's been set." He is disappointed at not having seen it, whatever it is, believing it a spiritual demonstration that Dixon almost certainly has failed to appreciate. Dixon, for his part, the further west they chain, finds himself with a need for some new jostling daily to his sensorium. And tonight's glowing Indian, in this numbing torrent of American stimuli, seems just the ticket, though he wouldn't have minded some whim-wham with the black dog. Wading down toward Antietam, last I saw, seemed a pleasant enough lad. Not much to say, too tall, of course. Over South Mountain, among the springs that fall to Antietam Creek, on September 21st, they pause at 96 miles, three chains, near the house of Mr. Staple Shockey, who tells them of a remarkable cavern beneath the earth, about 6 miles south of the line. In the winter, English church services are held in it. Mason's hat begins to move, as from some agitation beneath it. Accordingly, the next Sunday they pay a visit, in company with Mr. Shockey and his children, whilst Mrs. Shockey remains at home with 1,000 chores that Sunday does not release her from. The entrance is an arch about 6 yards in length and 4 feet in height, when immediately there opens a room 45 yards in length, 40 in breadth, and 7 or 8 in height. Not one pillar to support nature's arch. On the side walls are drawn by the pencil of time with the tiers of the rocks, the imitation of organ, pillar, columns, and monuments of a temple, which, with the glimmering faint light, makes the whole an awful, solemn appearance.